He looked gloomy, but he was otherwise aging well, trim, graying at the temples. He was what's referred to as Black Irish, which is to say black-haired and blue-eyed, an irresistible combination from my perspective. I'd first met him when he was working missing persons, and I was looking for one. For years, he'd been married to a girl he'd met in seventh grade when they both were 13 years old. He thought marriage was for life, but Camilla's commitment was on again, off again. She left him at intervals, taking their two daughters with her, leaving Jonah with a year's worth of frozen dinners she'd done up herself. Jonah was hopelessly smitten with her, and the worse she treated him, the more hooked he seemed to be. At one point, she left with the two girls and came home pregnant by someone else. Jonah took her back without a murmur of complaint. That little boy, Banner, was coming up on 3 years old by my count. Rosie appeared from the kitchen and made a brief stop at the bar before she headed in our direction. Now that police department personnel were gracing the tavern, she'd begun to make eye contact with new patrons, whereas before she generally looked to me or to someone familiar to translate requests from strangers. She delivered a fresh glass of Michelob on tap for Jonah and a basket of freshly popped corn for the table. I sprinkled Parmesan cheese over the surface and began to munch. "What's happened to you? You look great," I said. "That's a backhanded compliment." "I didn't mean it that way. You look fabulous." "What makes you say that?" he asked. "I'm not fishing for compliments. I'm really curious." I studied him. "Good haircut. You've lost weight. You look rested. Also depressed, but that's not always unattractive in a guy. Camilla's back." "Good news." "She's perimenopausal." I paused with a handful of popcorn halfway to my mouth. "Which is what?" "Hot flashes and night sweats, irregular menses, loss of libido, vaginal dryness, urinary tract infections."
"Shit, Jonah, I'm trying to eat."
"You asked."
"I thought you'd talk about mood swings."
"Yeah, well, those two. She says she's home for good, no more fooling around."
"Then why so glum?"
"I just got used to her being gone. The girls have been living with me for the past year, and we do great. Camilla parked Banner with us when she took off. That was last September, as a matter of fact. Kids in preschool, bright, verbal, well-adjusted. She comes back, and now he's wetting the bed and socking classmates in the mouth. I get calls from his school twice a week. Camilla wants us in counseling, and she thinks he should be on medication." I decided to steer off that subject. The pair had been in counseling off and on for years at Camilla's insistence, and look where it had gotten them. "How old are the girls now?" "Courtney's 17, Ashley's 15.
"Are you serious?"
"Sure. That's them over there."
Astonished, I turned and stared. These were the two young women in consultation with Anna Dace.
All three of them were gorgeous, which I'm sure wasn't true of me at that age.
"I don't believe it."
"Trust me."
"Hey, no offense intended, but I remember snaggled teeth, tangled hair, weak chins, and bodies shaped like sausages. What happened?"
"All it took was countless beauty products and $7,000 in braces."
"Not Dr. Stallings, by any chance?"
"Dr. White," he said.
"Well, they look fantastic," I said. "They must be happy to have Camilla home."
"Ha! They hate it. She's all over them. No phone calls after 6 p.m., no boys coming to the house, curfews at 9.
"Doesn't sound bad to me. So what's your parental game plan?"
"I don't need a game plan. I treat them like adults. All it takes is common sense. She doesn't have a clue what they're about."
I checked my watch and made a face. "Wow, 8:45. With a 9 o'clock curfew, shouldn't they be heading home?"
"This is my night out with them. She's got Banner,"
I said. "Fun. Just like being divorced. Which of you pays child support?"
"Don't make jokes."
"Sorry. I didn't mean to be flippant," I said. "So what happens now?"
"I expect we'll work it out.
Change is tough. The glum expression was back after the few brief moments of animation. Jonah, how long has this been going on? 5 years? 10? As long as you buy into the program, why would anything change? You're missing the point. My parents were divorced. I wouldn't wish that on any kid. I didn't think I'd miss the point at all, but there was no arguing with the man. I glanced at the door just as Henry came in. Henry's here. I'll catch you later. Good luck. Good seeing you, he said. You too. I eased out of the booth, relieved at the excuse. There's nothing as aggravating as watching someone else make a hash of life. Jonah had all the cards, and he refused to play the hand. What was Camilla's hold on him? I hadn't seen her for years, and then only at a distance. The woman had to be a bombshell. Why had he put up with her? He was good-hearted, handsome, steady, responsible, even-tempered. I dallied with a man myself on a couple of occasions when Camilla had gone off to find herself. It hadn't taken me long to figure out that Jonah was never going to set himself free. He knew better, but unhappiness was apparently preferable to taking risks. I crossed to Henry's table, taking my wine glass with me. How was class? I asked as I sat down. He made a face, tongue out, eyes crossed. I left early. It's not that Gray Water's boring, but the subject does have its limits. How are things with you? Nothing much to report. There's your friend Ruthie. I followed his gaze and spotted Ruthie coming in the door. I waved and she wound her way among the empty tables. Ruthie was in her mid-60s, tall and thin, with a lean face, a high forehead, and gray-brown hair she wore in a braid down her back. Her jeans, sweatshirt, and running shoes seemed incongruous on someone who seemed innately elegant. When she reached us, I said, "Good, you got my message." She looked at me blankly. "What message?" "The one I left an hour ago. I just stopped by the house and there wasn't anything on my machine. What was the message?" "That I'd be here, and if you were up for it, I'd buy you a drink. Isn't that why you came?" Henry stood and pulled out a chair for her. She said thanks and sat down. "I came looking for you. I thought you were always here. When I drove past your place and saw the lights were out, I made a beeline." "Why were you looking for me?" "Being alone in that house has been giving me the creeps." She turned in her chair, looking around with interest. "Has this place changed hands? I remember beefy guys in baseball uniforms, spilling beer and smoking cigarettes. The quiet is lovely." "The sports enthusiasts have moved on, and now we have off-duty cops, which is better from my perspective." Henry said, "Can I buy you a drink?" "Vodka martini, 3 olives, thanks for asking." "What about you, Kinsey?" "I'm fine for now." "I'll be right back," he said. Ruthie watched him cross to the bar. "How old is he?" 89. She studied him. "He's cute. Really, he doesn't seem old to me. Does he seem old to you?"
"Knock it off, Ruthie. I got dibs on him."
We chatted about nothing in particular, and it wasn't until Henry returned, carrying her martini and a blackjack for himself, that she brought up the subject of the box.
"So, how'd it go?" she asked.
"The search was a bust, which was also part of the message you missed."
"You didn't find anything?"
"Nope."
"Oh, too bad. I was hoping you'd provide me with ammunition."
Henry sat down and carefully placed Ruthie's martini in front of her.
"Ammunition for what?"
"Hang on," she said. She held up an index finger, and I watched her lift the icy vodka to her lips and take a sip. She made that sound that only a vodka martini seems to inspire among connoisseurs.
"That is so fine."
I answered on her behalf while she savored the alcohol. "She has an appointment with the IRS tomorrow, trying to sidestep an audit. She was hoping I could provide documentation, but no such luck."
"Oh, well," she said. "What are they going to do, put me in jail?"
I said, Actually, I found something else. It probably won't help, but it's interesting. I leaned to my right and plucked the piece of graph paper from the outside pocket in my shoulder bag. I unfolded the page and put it on the table in front of her, then pointed to the grid of numbers. You have any idea what this is? I watched her eyes take in the numbers on the page. Looks like gibberish, but it's Pete's handwriting. No doubt about that, she said. He loved graph paper, and he was a big fan of those technical pens. He kept dozens on hand. Henry leaned forward with interest. Code. I turned to look at him. You sure about that? Of course. It's alphanumeric and not terribly sophisticated. If I'm correct, he assigned a number to each letter of the alphabet and then grouped the letters in fours to make it trickier to crack. How did you come up with that? Ruthie asked. I play word games, cryptograms, anagrams, word scrambles. You see him in the paper every day. Haven't you ever done one? Not me. Pete loved that stuff. Most days I feel dumb enough as it is, which is why I don't do crossword puzzles. She pointed at the page. So, translate, I'd love to hear this. I can't off the top of my head. I'd have to work with it. Let me take a look. He picked up the paper and let his eye run down the columns from left to right. This is actually a cipher as opposed to a code. In a true code, each word is replaced by a specific word, which means you have to have a big, awkward code book to accompany your secret messages. No respectable spy does that in this day and age. Plain English, please. I'm not following, Ruthie said. It's not difficult. In a cipher, each letter is replaced by a different letter or symbol. This looks like a simple number substitution. If he'd stuck to ordinary English, we could start breaking it down by looking for single letters, which are almost always I or A. What else? Ruthie asked, chin on her palm. Really, I could have done without her moony-eyed look at him. Henry tapped the paper. A two-letter word usually has one vowel and one consonant. Of, to, in, it, and so forth. Or you might start with short words, was, the, for, and. E is the most commonly used letter in the English language, followed by T, A, and then O. I said, I figured the zeros were placeholders. That would be my guess. Rounding out the grid, he said. A block of numbers has an elegant look, as opposed to ragtag lines of different lengths. Wonder why he went to so much trouble, I said. He must have worried someone would read his notes, he said. Where did you find this? He'd slipped it between the pages of a document, a lawsuit dating back to the old Bird Shine days. You think the two are related? Henry asked. No clue, I said. Ruthie warned me about his habit of hiding papers, so I was turning files upside down, riffling pages when it fell out. If he hid this, the information must have been sensitive. I took a few minutes to describe the compartment at the bottom of the box, and then detailed what I'd found in the padded mailing pouch. The Mother's Day card, the two photographs, the birthday card, the rosary and the Bible embossed with Lenore Redfern's name. A regular treasure trove, Henry remarked. Wonder how it ended up in Pete's possession. No telling. The pouch was mailed to a Father Xavier at St. Elizabeth's Parish in Burning Oaks, California. This was in March of 1961. Ruthie said, I remember Pete's driving to Burning Oaks, but that must have been sometime in March of last year. He never said a word about a Catholic priest. I also came across a wedding announcement he'd clipped from the dispatch. This was the marriage of a young woman named April Lowe and a dentist named William Stallings. What's the relevance? Henry asked. April's the daughter of the defendant in that same lawsuit, a man named Ned Lowe. Must have rung a bell, he said. Which would explain why he saved the announcement, but not why he made the trip to Burning Oaks, Ruth replied. Henry pondered the point. Might be part of an investigation. From what Kinsey's told me, he was once a fine detective. I couldn't remember ever voicing such a claim, but I kept my mouth shut on the off chance he was simply being kind. Ruthie smiled. He was a good detective. Ben used to say Pete had a nose for iniquity. In his heyday, at any rate, she amended.
I remember that, I said. One of Ben's rare compliments where Pete Walensky was concerned.
So perhaps he was persuaded to take a case, Henry said.
Ruth made a face.
I doubt it. He only had one paying client the whole of last year.
Might have been pro bono work, Henry said.
Good sweet Henry, I thought, working so hard to make Pete look like a better guy than he was.
I appreciate your defense of him, but let's be honest. We are what we are, she said.
He could have had a crisis of conscience, Henry said.
Just because he made one mistake doesn't mean every choice he made was wrong. People change. Sometimes we have reason to stop and take stock.
Ruth regarded him with interest.
Actually, you might have a point.
You knew he had Marfan syndrome.
Kinsey mentioned it. One of the complications is an enlarged thoracic aorta. A ruptured aneurysm's fatal in minutes. So Pete had an annual echocardiogram to monitor his condition. After his physical in February, his doctor told me he'd urged Pete to have surgery to make the repair. Pete never said a word to me, and knowing him, he blocked the idea entirely. What he didn't want to deal with, he put out of his mind and never thought about again.
Henry cleared his throat.
You're saying if the shooting hadn't killed him, he might be dead anyway.
Ruthie shrugged.
More or less.
The point is, Pete told the doctor he'd already lived more years than he had any reason to expect. On one hand, he was a fatalist. What will be. On the other hand, why risk surgery?
I don't understand how this relates, I said.
Henry turned to me.
She's saying I might be right. He knew all that stood between him and death was a roll of the dice. If he discovered something significant, he might have translated the information into code as a way of hiding it.
Ruthie closed her eyes.
You're a nice man, she said. And don't I wish that it were true.
Chapter 9. In the morning, I arrived at work at 8 o'clock on the dot, toting the banker's box I'd retrieved from the trunk of my car. I sidestepped the pile of mail that had been shoved through the slot from the afternoon before and proceeded into my inner office. I dropped the banker's box and my shoulder bag on the desk and walked down the hall to the kitchenette, where I put on a pot of coffee. While the coffee brewed, I picked up the mail and sorted through the accumulation of bills and junk. Most of it I tossed. Once the coffee was done, I returned to the kitchenette and poured myself a mug. I set down the mug and took the lid off the box. I piled the files on my desk, removed the false cardboard floor, and took out the mailing pouch. I crossed to the near corner, pulled back a flap of carpeting, and opened my floor safe. I had to bend one end of the mailing pouch in order to make it fit, but it seemed like a better idea than leaving it where it was. I locked the safe, put the carpet back in place, and pressed it flat with my foot. I repacked the files and set the box on the floor near my office door. I'd just settled at my desk when I heard the door in the outer office open and close. "I'm in here," I called. The man who appeared in the doorway looked familiar. Offhand, I couldn't place him, but I pegged him as a cop of the plain clothes variety. Late 30s, nice-looking, with a long, narrow face and hazel eyes.
"Detective Nash," he said, introducing himself.
He opened his coat to reveal his badge, but I confess I didn't peer closely enough to commit the number to memory. This was because his badge was attached to his belt in close proximity to his fly, and I didn't want to seem too interested.
"Sorry to barge in unannounced," he went on.
"Not a problem," I said. I stood and we shook hands across the desk.
"Have we met before? You look familiar."
He handed me a business card that identified him as Sergeant Detective Spencer Nash of the Investigative Division of the Santa Teresa Police Department.
"Actually, we have. Mind if I sit?"
"Sorry, of course. Be my guest."
Detective Nash took one of my two visitors' chairs and gave the place a cursory assessment while I did the same with him. He wore dark slacks and a blue dress shirt with a tie, but no sport coat.
You used to be over on State Street, the 900 block.
That was 6 years ago. I was working for California Fidelity Insurance in exchange for office space. Did our paths cross back then?
Once, in passing. There was a homicide in the parking lot. I was a beat officer and first at the scene.
I felt a small flash of recollection, and an image of him popped up. I pointed. A claims adjuster was shot to death. I'd just driven up from San Diego and stopped by the office to drop off some files. You were manning the crime scene tape when I asked for Lieutenant Dolan. I remember you had a little divot right here in your front tooth.
Dimples appeared as he ran his index finger across his front teeth. I had it fixed the next week. I can't believe you remember.
A quirk of mine, I said. How'd you chip it?
Bit down on a piece of floral wire. My wife was making a wreath with pine cones and one of those styrofoam rings. You wouldn't think a little nick would be so conspicuous, but I felt like a redneck every time I opened my mouth.
That's what you get for being helpful, I remarked. Bet your mom told you not to use your teeth for stuff like that.
Yes, she did.
I glanced at his card. You've moved up in the world.
I work property crimes these days.
I half expected him to take out a pen and notebook, getting down to the business at hand, but he was apparently content to take his time. Meanwhile, I reviewed my behavior, doing a quick scan of present and past sins. While I'm occasionally guilty of violating municipal codes, I hadn't done anything lately.
Was there a burglary in the neighborhood?
I'm here about something else.
Not something I did, I hope.
Indirectly.
I thought, shit, now what?
He took his time, probably deciding how much he wanted to share.
A marked bill was passed in this area a week ago.
I watched him, waiting for the rest of it.
We believe it came from you.
Me?
I don't think so, I said. Do you remember using cash for a transaction on the 6th?
No, you want to give me a hint?
I could, but I'd prefer not to color your recollection.
What's to color? I don't remember anything of the sort.
Take your time.
I was getting annoyed. What kind of bill? 5, 10, 20? He jerked his thumb upward. 100? I don't carry hundreds. They're useless. Too hard to change.
I was about to go on when an uh-oh popped to mind. I leaned forward and squinted.
Are you talking about the $100 bill I used to pay for groceries last week?
He pointed at me like he was calling on me in class. Can you tell me where you were?
At the grocery store, obviously. The Alpha Beta Market on Old Coast Road in Montebello.
I was only adding the details to show I had nothing to hide. My righteous tone sounded bogus, but that might have had more to do with the look he was giving me.
We're wondering how that particular bill ended up in your hands.
I was hired to do a job, and I was paid in cash, I said.
That bill was phony?
Not quite. 6 months ago, the Alpha Beta chain initiated use of a device that counts, sorts, and bans currency. It's also programmed to spot counterfeits and capture serial numbers. The machine tagged the bill as marked, and the store manager tracked it to the cashier who took it in trade. She doesn't usually work that shift, so she remembered the transaction.
Suzanne, I said, supplying her name.
What kind of job did you do?
None of your business.
Hired by whom? He asked, not the least bit perturbed.
I hesitated. I'm not sure I should tell you my client's name. Give me a minute to think about it.
I can do that. When were you hired?
That same night. So you're telling me that bill was marked?
Not literally marked. We recorded serial numbers on a stack of cash that changed hands 2 years ago in the course of a felony.
What felony?
I'll get to that in a bit. I have a few questions first, if you don't object.
I might object. I don't know yet. Why don't you ask me, and I'll tell you what I can.
He opened his notebook, flipping to a blank page, and clicked the tip of a ballpoint pen into place.
Let's go back to your client's name. I went through a hasty internal debate. If I'd been working for an attorney in a civil or criminal matter, the question of confidentiality would have been clear-cut. In my dealings with Hallie Betancourt, there were no legal issues at stake. The information I'd been hired to find seemed uncomplicated on the face of it. If Hallie paid me with tainted cash, the act might or might not have been intentional. Therefore, what? My recollection of the ethical niceties was as follows. No privilege exists between the investigator and a third party, nor does it exist in communications outside the scope of the reason for legal representation. So, how did that apply to the current circumstance? Was I at liberty to blab her business to this nice, plain-clothes police detective? Ordinarily, I am protective of clients, but in this case, I thought a police inquiry took precedence. Hallie Betancourt, I said. I paused to spell her name for him and watched him make a note of it before I went on. Now it's my turn to ask. We'll trade off. You ask me, and then I'll ask you.
Fair enough. Go ahead.
You said felony. So, what was the crime? I watched him deciding how forthcoming he should be, the same debate he'd gone through moments before. Finally, he said, 1987, a painting was stolen from a wealthy Montebello resident. His collection was uninsured, and the painting in question was valued at $1.2 million. Yikes! That was my reaction. He was in a white-hot sweat to get the painting back and decided to offer a reward. We opposed the plan, but you can only push people so far, and he ended up winning the argument. He posted the reward, and shortly afterward, someone contacted him, claiming to know the painting's whereabouts, which someone would be happy to confide as soon as the arrangements were made, I said. How much was the reward?
$15,000.
The caller was a she in this case, he said. The woman insisted on the reward being bumped from $15,000 to $25,000, $5,000 of it in $100 bills, and the rest in smaller denominations.
More like ransom.
Exactly. My turn now, isn't it? I conceded the point with a careless wave of my hand. He checked his notes. Aside from that Monday, how many times did you meet with your client?
First and only time. She lives up on Skyview in Montebello, off Winding Canyon Road, the old Clipper estate, in case you're about to ask. I gave him the house number and watched him make a note. I can't believe I missed this whole ransom thing.
It was only in the paper briefly. A reporter got wind of it and ran with the story before we could shut her down. We wanted to keep a lid on it, figuring if word got out we'd have a rash of copycats, he said. He checked his notes again. Can you give me Ms. Betancourt's phone number?
I didn't get a local number. There wasn't any need. When she called the office, I was here and I picked up the phone. After we met, I didn't have occasion to call her. She was leaving town the next morning, so she gave me a couple of numbers in Malibu. She and her husband have a second home down there. He has an office in Malibu as well. As he was about to ask anyway, I reached into my bag and pulled out my index cards, sorting through until I found the relevant numbers, which I recited while he made notes.
And she hired you to do what?
My turn.
What happened to the reward? Did the woman collect?
Unfortunately, yes. We advised the victim not to pay, but he was adamant.
The best we could do was talk him into letting us record the serial numbers on the bills. Long story short, he paid, the painting came back, and that was the end of it until that bill showed up, he said.
What did she hire you to do?
Another quick debate. But I couldn't see how the job I'd been hired to do was in any way connected to the painting for ransom scheme. She wanted contact information for a kid she put up for adoption 32 years ago. The story's more complicated, but essentially that's it.
Whose idea was the cash?
I thought back to the conversation.
Hers, though I'd have suggested it if she hadn't brought it up herself. She said she'd be out of town until June. Under the circumstances, I would have been leery about taking a check.
Please note, I just allowed you an extra question.
You're sure the bill came from her and not someone else?
Positive. I stopped at the market on the way home. I don't usually carry hundreds. The money was in an envelope I put in my shoulder bag, and I spent it within the hour. While we're on the subject, I've already done the job and put my report in the mail, if it's relevant. You think the same woman stole the painting? Possible, he said. He squinted at me in delayed disbelief. You did a job for $100? Oh, sorry. She offered 5, but that was too much, given what I'd been asked to do. I suggested 2, and that's what she ended up paying me.
Still sounds like a bargain.
It does, doesn't it? I hesitated and then said, crap.
I guess you might as well have the other 100. You'll ask for it anyway.
I reached into my shoulder bag and removed the envelope from the outer pocket, holding it by one corner. My prints are on this, but so are hers. Run 'em, and you might get a hit in case she turns out to be a criminal mastermind. He smiled.
I'll mention that to the techs. Chances are she came by the cash the same way you did, but maybe we can track it back to the source.
Meanwhile, what? I'm out the money?
I'm afraid so. The supermarket lost out, too, if you want to get right down to it. The bill you passed, they turned over to us without recompense. At least you got groceries out of the deal.
I hope they don't take it out of Suzanne's pay, I said.
Depends on store policy.
I'm guessing not. I thought about his story. You said this was 2 years ago. I wonder why the money's showing up now.
No idea.
But clearly someone's been sitting on it, right?
Theoretically, yes. Some of it could have been circulated in other parts of the country. We have no way of knowing that.
Bad papers, a bitch, I said. You need anything else?
Nope. What about you? Any questions?
I'd like a receipt for that bill, which I'm assuming will be booked in as evidence.
Oh, right.
I watched while he fashioned a receipt, writing down the date and serial number before he passed it across the desk to me.
I hope your client makes good on the loss, he said.
Hey, me too, but I wouldn't count on it.
Probably smart. In the meantime, this is a sensitive operation, so steer clear if you would.
He stirred and stood up. I stood at the same time.
He said, "We appreciate your cooperation. Sorry to be the bearer of bad news."
"Not your fault. If I hear from her again, I'll be happy to let you know." He pointed to the phone number on his business card.
"That's my private line. You need me, leave a message and I'll get back to you. I'm currently on loan to an FBI ATF task force. Technically, the PD's not involved, and they want to keep it that way. You call the department looking for me, they're going to play dumb."
"Got it," I said. We shook hands again, as though closing a deal. "Thanks for the backstory. You didn't have to put me in the loop on this."
"We'd be grateful for any help."
The minute I heard the door close behind him, I opened Hallie's file again and tried her home phone in Malibu. After 3 rings, I got a message saying the number was not in service. Odd. I tried her husband's 2 office numbers with the same result. I could feel the mental punctuation form above my head. A question mark and an exclamation point. Chapter 10. I leaned back in my swivel chair and put my feet on the desk while I did a quick assessment. Hallie didn't strike me as a high-end art thief, but what did I know? She'd told me her husband didn't have a job, so maybe this was his way of generating income, stealing art and trading it back to the rightful owner in exchange for a reward. Detective Nash had suggested I leave the matter to law enforcement, but he hadn't forbidden me to do anything, not that a clever course of action occurred to me. For now, the situation was irksome, but not pressing. True, I'd done the work and shipped off my report. Also true, groceries aside, I was no longer in possession of the cash I'd been paid. Added to that annoyance was the fact that the phone numbers she'd given me were duds. On the plus side, I knew where she lived, so she'd have a tough time dodging me once she returned in June. Worst case scenario? I'd wait until then, explain the difficulty, and ask to be reimbursed. If she'd been the inadvertent recipient of marked bills, She'd be as irritated as I was to hear the cash was now evidence in a criminal case. Even if she felt no obligation to make good, I was only out $100. I wanted what I was due, but with a shitload of money in the bank, I wasn't desperate. I should have relegated the issue to the back of my brain, but alas, I could not. I picked up the handset and rang Vera at home. 3 rings, 4. I was gratified when she finally picked up, though she did seem winded. "Hey, Vera, this is Kinsey. Did I catch you on the run?" "What makes you ask? The fact that I'm huffing and puffing and gasping for breath?" "Pretty much," I said. "If this is a bad time, I can try you later." "This is fine. To what do I owe this rare contact?" "I'll overlook the snotty remark," I said. "I need to contact Hallie Betancourt, but the number she gave me in Malibu turned out to be no good." There was a moment of silence. "I don't know anyone named Hallie." "Sure you do. You met her at a party and gave her my name." "Nope. Don't think so. When was this?" "A couple of weeks ago. I don't know the date." "I haven't been to a party in 2 years." "Okay, maybe not a party, but a social gathering of some sort. You had a conversation with a woman who needed the services of a private investigator." "No."
"Don't be so quick. I haven't finished yet. She was trying to locate the kid she gave up at birth, and you thought I could help, which I did."
"I have no idea what you're talking about."
"I did a job for a woman named Hallie Betancourt, who said she met you in passing."
"You've said that already, and I'm still not following."
"I'm pregnant with twins. Enormous. We're talking the size of a whale. 7 months. Actually, it's closer to 8. I don't drink, I don't go out, and the only people I talk to are under 36 inches tall. Except Neil, of course. I hope I don't sound bitter or cross."
"A tiny bit cross," I said. "Not to argue the point, but I only took the job because she mentioned you by name. Otherwise, I might have turned her down." I was fibbing, of course. I'd been delighted to be gainfully employed.
"What's her name again?"
"Betancourt. First name, Hallie. Her husband is Jeffrey. Last name, unknown. This is one of those modern marriages where everybody hangs on to what's his or hers. They live on the old Clipper estate, half the year at any rate. The rest of the time they're in Malibu or traveling the world. Tough life."
Kinsey?
"The Clipper estate's empty and has been for years. No one's lived in that house since the old lady died back in 1963.
"Bullshit. I met Hallie up there a week ago."
"No, you didn't."
"Yes, I did."
"No."
"Yes, Vera."
Slowly, as though to a half-wit, I said,
"Here's how it went, and I will swear to this. She called and set up a meeting to discuss a personal matter. On your say-so, please note. I drove up to the house. We had wine on the deck looking out over the city while she told me a long, sad tale about the baby she gave up for adoption 32 years ago."
"Did you find him?"
"Yes, I did.
He's a safecracker turned bank robber just out of prison, and I've already sent her the information she asked for."
"She set you up. She must have talked a good game."
"I don't see how she could have been bullshitting. She told me all kinds of things about the house."
"For instance, what?"
"For instance, her father's the famous architect who tore down the original Georgian mansion and built the contemporary structure that's up there now."
"Her father?"
"Halston Betancourt, at least I think that's his name."
"Wrong again.
Her name was Ingrid Merchant. She was a San Francisco architect who was all the rage in the 1930s.
"I don't think so," I said. I did hear the note of uncertainty that had crept into my voice.
"Are you sure about that?"
With exaggerated patience, she said, "I know I'm hormonal. I know my IQ's dropped a good 20 points, but I'm still the reigning queen of local real estate. That's what I do for jollies when I'm not giving birth."
"I remember that. You scour the Sunday papers and go to all the open houses. Your knowledge is encyclopedic."
"That's right, which is how I know about the Clipper estate. It's a relic, a white elephant. It's been on the market so long, it's a joke.
The foundation's cracked and the wooden joists are riddled with termites. The only thing holding it together is the selling agent's high hopes. Hallie Betancourt set you up.
How many children do you have now?
Including the soon-to-be-born twins? 5.
What happened to Peter and Meg?
Those are my first two. They still live with us. Not to accuse you of any neglect, but you missed Abigail entirely. And you're just about to miss Travis and Scott.
Maybe I'll stop by sometime, I said weakly.
She didn't actually hang up on me. There was some kind of ruckus in the background, and I heard her say, "Oh, shit." Then the line went dead. I stared at the phone. This was bad. Worse than I'd thought. Had Hallie lied to me about everything? It was clear she played fast and loose, but what was the point? She'd conned me into doing the legwork in her efforts to locate an ex-con named Christian Satterfield, who might not be related to her at all. He was, for real, a convicted bank robber out on parole. I'd seen the article about his crime spree, and I'd seen the man himself, at least as far as I could tell in the dark and at a distance. I'd provided Hallie with contact information, neatly keeping her name out of it as requested. But the story about giving a child up for adoption now seemed questionable. I wasn't even sure the name Hallie Betancourt was real. Probably not, now that I thought about it. There had to be a way to track her down. How could she appear and disappear without leaving a trace? I picked up my leather bag by the strap and slung it over my shoulder, fishing in one of the outer pockets for my keys. I locked the office and trotted out to my car. I took the back road through town, skirting the city limits as I hit the 192 and headed east toward the Clipper estate. Now the route looked different, nearly disorienting with its surfeit of visual information. At night, many houses disappeared, fading into the surrounding darkness under the cover of trees. During the daylight hours, the trajectory of the east-west mountain range was brought into high relief. Sunlight warmed the chaparral, and the dry conditions intensified the volatile oils in the dense, low-growing vegetation. The still air was heavy with the woody smell of eucalyptus, black sage, and California lilac. Manzanitas and canyon live oaks, while drought-tolerant, are also highly flammable. Nature's bottle rockets. Given current conditions, with the slightest miscalculation in human judgment, the landscape could ignite, turning into an ocean of fire that would take everything in its path. I turned left onto winding canyon road, following a series of switchbacks that angled ever upward. Houses were fewer here, and farther between. There were no intervening side roads. An occasional driveway led off to some unseen habitat, but I saw no other motorists. I spotted the big sandstone boulder with the house number blasted into it, and I turned in as I had the week before. When I reached the parking area below the house, I shut down my engine and got out. I stood for a moment, turning by degrees until I'd taken in the whole of the property, which Vera claimed had been on the market for years. Of course, there was no for sale sign. Montebello residents frown on anything so crass. I suspect in any economic decline, countless homes are listed on the quiet, with no suggestion to the outside world that owners are scrambling around trying to scare up quick cash. I lifted my gaze to the house that towered over me. The expanses of exterior glass looked blank and lifeless. Before believing someone was in residence, I'd seen signs of life, projecting the appropriate appearances. Now, if what Vera had told me was correct, I was seeing the structure as it really was, deserted and suffering neglect. Scanning the foundation, I didn't spot any cracks, but maybe they'd been puttied over and painted to match the rest of the poured concrete footing. I could certainly see where the termites were at work. A moldering cord of firewood had been stacked up against the house on the uphill side where it was cozied up next to an exposed beam. Some of the quarter logs looked fresh, and I was guessing that if a tree went down, the gardener assigned to maintain the property dutifully split and stacked the wood. Aside from that,
There were no other indications that anyone had tended to the place in recent months. I climbed the rugged stone stairs, careful where I stepped. When I reached the front door, I cupped my hands to the glass and peered in. The place was empty. No paintings, no furniture, no tarps, no glowing lamps. The floors were plain wood with no sign of the oriental carpets I'd seen. I realized my perceptions on the prior occasion were colored by my expectations. Now the white walls were bare and looked slightly dingy. I tried the knob and found it locked. I followed the deck as it skirted the house in a wide arc. On the far side, looking out over the city, the view seemed flat, two-dimensional instead of the diorama I'd admired by night. On the terrace below, the infinity pool was hidden under a tattered automated cover. There were no deck chairs, no side table, no heaters, no remnant of fine Chardonnay. Dead leaves were scattered across the surface of the deck. Caught here and there, the wind had blown them up against the railing. I glanced down. There, between the beveled planks of the decking, I saw a line of dull silver. I squatted and peered, then used my thumbnail to loosen and lift the object. I held it up with a long, slow smile. "First mistake," I said aloud. This was the paperclip Hallie had used to secure the copies of the newspaper article she'd given me. I did a full exterior search, checking two trash cans, which were empty. I'd hoped to find the Chardonnay bottle, but maybe she'd taken it back to the liquor store, hoping for the deposit. Pick away as I might with the sprung paperclip, I couldn't jimmy any of the locks, so I had to be content with peering into assorted windows as I circled the house. If the house had been on the market for years, there must be some provision for local agents to get into the place to show prospective buyers. I looked around with interest. Where would I put a lockbox if I were in charge? Not on the front or back doors. That would have been the same as an invitation for someone to break and enter, which is against the law. I went down the outside stairs to ground level and went around the house again. Tough work on a hillside that steep. I just about reached my original point of departure when I found an old-fashioned lockbox attached to a hose bib and secured by a combination lock. I checked the lockbox, surprised the device wasn't electronically controlled. Maybe no one had thought to replace it with one more sophisticated. In my perimeter search, I hadn't come across evidence of an alarm system. If the place had been empty since the 60s, it was possible proper security had never been installed. The lock was small and looked about as effective as the ones on rolling suitcases. There were four rotating wheels numbered 0 through 9. Even with my rudimentary math skills, I was looking at 10 times 10 times 10 times 10, or 10,000 possibilities. I tapped an index finger against my lips, trying to determine how much time that would take. More than I could spare. I trudged a few steps up the hill to the woodpile, grabbed a handsome chunk of freshly split oak, returned to the lockbox, and hauled back in my best batter-up mode. I swung and whacked the lock so hard it flew off into the brush, and then I picked up the key. Chapter 11. My tour of the interior was largely unproductive. Hallie Betancourt had left nothing behind. Somehow she'd managed to furnish the place and then eliminate any trace of physical evidence. Except for the paperclip, of course, which is so ubiquitous as to be insignificant. The house had that odd smell that seems to emerge when human occupants have moved on. I wandered down the hall and peered into the powder room. I tried the wall switch. The power was on. I turned the faucet and discovered the water had been shut off. I moved on to the kitchen. While the residence was designed along sleek, contemporary lines, the bathroom and kitchen fixtures were 50 years old and looked every bit of it. What was top of the line when the house was built was by now sadly outdated. The walls had recently been painted white, but in the spots where two coats had failed to cover, I could see the original pea-green hue. The counters and splashboards were tiled in white, 3x6 rectangles laid horizontally.
Subway-style tiling is all the rage again, but here the look was curiously dated. Appliances had been removed, and the refrigerator and stove-sized gaps made the room seem stark and unfriendly. A breakfast nook at one end of the room sported a built-in table with a bench on either side. The padded seats were upholstered in a fabric I remembered from one of the trailers we'd lived in when I was growing up. The pattern bore a black background with violins, clarinets, and jaunty musical notes in lemon, lime, and tangerine. I couldn't imagine why the seat fabric hadn't been freshened, but maybe the vintage look was thought to contribute a note of authenticity. I slid into the bench seat and pretended I was a family member waiting for the maid to bring me my breakfast of cream of wheat, sweeback, canned orange juice, and Ovaltine. In the center of the table there was a stack of flyers detailing the number of bedrooms, 6, the number of bathrooms, 7, and the pedigree of the house, which was on the National Register of Historic Places. I studied the particulars. According to the hype, the architect was indeed Ingrid Merchant, whose landmark work was coveted among home buyers in Montebello. A line in small print at the bottom read, "Price available upon request," meaning a sum so astronomical the agent didn't dare write it down. Someone had provided the floor plan, showing rooms that were surprisingly small and poorly laid out for a structure that appeared so grandiose from the outside. The listing was held by Montebello Luxury Properties. The agent was Nancy Harkness. A 2x4 color photograph of her showed a woman in her 50s with streaked blonde hair worn in a shoulder-length bob, immobilized by spray. I folded the flyer and put it in my bag. I was already leaning toward not buying the place, but I wanted to be fair. With a property on the market as long as this one had been, there was probably some wiggle room in the asking price. It had been clever of Hallie to whisk me through the dining room to the deck beyond, with its cozy propane heaters and its stunning views. I was so dazzled by the expensive wine and her exotic yellow caftan, it hadn't occurred to me to look closer. Lucky for her. If I'd asked to use the ladies' room, she'd have been forced to refuse. In the 7 bathrooms I'd seen, there wasn't even one roll of toilet paper. As there seemed to be nothing left to discover, I let myself out the front door and locked it behind me. I scrambled partway down the hill and shuffled through the underbrush until I found the combination lock. I returned the key to the lockbox and left the lock dangling ineffectually in the busted hasp. I was guessing the entire search, including breaking and entering, had taken less than 30 minutes. Since I was already in the Montebello area, I wound my way down the mountain and drove into the lower village. Montebello Luxury Properties was tucked into a quaint cottage with an undulating thatched roof, mullioned windows, and a Dutch door painted red. There was a modest strip of parking to one side, and I snagged the only available space. I locked my car and went in, activating an old-fashioned shopkeeper's bell on a spring. I knew I wasn't projecting the image of someone wealthy enough to be house-hunting in Montebello, unless I was pegged as one of the eccentric rich dressed like a bag lady. The interior had been renovated and enlarged to a sprawling warren of offices, the entrance to which was guarded by a receptionist whose nameplate identified her as Kim Bass, receptionist. Like I might have mistaken her for the company president. She was chatting on the phone, taking notes on a spiral-bound stenographer's pad. When I reached her desk, her gaze rested on me briefly, then returned to her notebook where she was busy scribbling information. She raised a finger, indicating she was aware of me. She said, "What time is the Cal Air on the 24th? She listened for a moment, saying, "Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And the Pan Am is at 10 p.m.? What's that number again?" She made a note. "Anything earlier out of ST? "No, that's fine. I was just asking on the off chance." I watched her write, "Cal Air 2287, depart STA 5:45 p.m., arrive LAX 6:52 p.m. Pan Am 154, depart LAX 10 p.m., arrive LHR 8:25 a.m. The entire page was covered by fragments, phone numbers without identifiers, names without references indicated. She knew what she meant while she was taking notes, and she assumed she'd remember what she was talking about, but when she came across the same page in 4 days, she'd be clueless. At the same time, she wouldn't have the nerve to throw out her scribbles in case the notes turned out to be critical. I finally got tired of being ignored and ambled over to the wall-mounted photographs of the current agents. The women outnumbered the men, and most were closer to 50 years old than 30. All of the names were easy to pronounce. Catherine Phillips was the number one sales associate for Montebello Luxury Properties, selling over $23 million for each of the past 3 years. Several exclamation points were affixed to the news. If the office took a 6% cut and Ms. Phillips collected even half of that amount, minus expenses, she was doing better than most. In her photograph, she appeared to be in her mid to late 60s and quite attractive. I sat down in one of the comfy upholstered visitor's chairs. Kim was still deep in her phone conversation. While I was cooling my heels, I cast about for a cover story to present as soon as she was free. I'd intended to slide in with a ruse that would allow me to pump the listing agent for information about the Clipper estate. Specifically, I was curious how someone might have commandeered the property as Hallie had. There was bound to be a system in place, but I wasn't sure how it worked. Agents from other companies had to be in possession of the combination that would open the lockbox that held the house key. Otherwise, Nancy Harkness would have to be present for every showing, a nuisance, if nothing else. I let my gaze drift back to Ms. Bass, who was now asking about United and Delta. I placed her in her 40s, dark-eyed, with red hair worn in a style that suggested a wind machine at work. She wore a tank top, and her arms were so beautifully muscled, I envied her. Her tan was uniformly dark except for a mottled streak along her left forearm where she'd misapplied her tan in a can. When I try such products, my skin takes on an orange tinge and smells faintly spoiled. To hurry her along, I got up and crossed to her desk. She made eye contact, apparently surprised to find me still waiting. She circled a set of numbers, murmured a few remarks, and hung up. She cocked her head in a deft move that shifted her torrent of hair. "May I help you?" I don't know how she managed it, but her tone implied I was the last person on earth she'd be willing to accommodate. "I'm here to see Nancy Harkness." No hesitation whatever. "She's gone for the day." I glanced at the wall clock. "It's 10:15. She has buyers in from out of town. Is there anything else?" "Actually, there is. I need information about the Clipper estate. She's the listing agent, isn't she?" Kim widened her eyes and worked to suppress a smile. "Are you in the market for a house?" "I am in the market for information about the Clipper estate." I had no sense of humor, whatever, and I thought I'd better make that clear. "If you leave a number, I can have her call you later in the week. She's tied up with clients for the next 3 days." I thought rapidly to the mugshots of other agents in the office and remembered only one. "What about Catherine Phillips? Is she here?" Kim Bass, receptionist, didn't look favorably upon this request. "I doubt she'd have time to see you. What's this in reference to?" She asked this as though I'd told her once and she'd forgotten what I said. "Business." "And you are?" I took out a card and placed it on the desk in front of her. She picked up the card and read it, then focused on me fully, a response I am often subject to from those who've had little or no experience with private investigators. "You're a private detective?" she asked. "I am." She waited for me to elaborate, and when I said nothing, she picked up the handset and pressed 2 numbers. Her expression suggested a smackdown was forthcoming from someone higher up in the chain of command. For this, she could hardly wait. "Good morning, Miss Phillips. I have someone here who'd like to see you." "No, ma'am. She doesn't have an appointment." There was a pause. Ms. Phillips was apparently asking for additional information. Kim shot me a look, and her gaze returned to the card I'd given her. "Kinsley Milhoney," she said, pronouncing Milhone as though the second syllable rhymed with baloney instead of bone. I leaned forward. Milhone. Accent on the first syllable. No point in tackling the Kinsley issue. Kim corrected herself, saying, Milhone. As she listened, her manner underwent a subtle shift.
Well, yes, ma'am. I'll let her know.
I can do that, she said. She hung up.
She'll be right out. May I offer you coffee or bottled water?
I'm fine, I said. I was as surprised as she was that Catherine Phillips intended to emerge from her office to greet me personally. No wonder she was first in her class. In a remarkably short period of time, she appeared from the corridor, holding out her hand.
So nice to meet you, she said warmly. I'm delighted you stopped by. Come on back to my office where we can chat.
We shook hands, and I worked to make my grip as firm and forthright as hers. I wanted to send Kim Bass a smug look, but I restrained myself. Miss Phillips ushered me into the corridor, and then moved ahead so she could show me the way. She was elegantly dressed in an understated way, black wool gabardine suit with a tailored jacket and knee-length skirt, white silk shell, medium heels with sheer black hose. She was trim, and her hair was unabashedly gray, blunt-cut, with a sheen to it. She reminded me of my Aunt Susanna, with whom I'd been smitten on sight. In moments like this, the desire for a mother fills me with something akin to pain. Mine died when I was 5, and I carry a vision of her like an exemplar against which all women are tested. Ordinarily, Rosie is as close to a mother as I get. Granted, she's opinionated, bossy, and overbearing, but at least she cares. This woman was my ideal. Warm, lovely, gracious, encompassing. My inner self mewed like a kitten, while my outer self sailed on. I hope Kim offered you coffee.
She did, thanks.
You couldn't have come at a better time. My 10 o'clock canceled, and I was at loose ends. I said,
ah.
This was worrisome.
She was being so nice.
She must have mistaken me for someone else, and what was I to say? I'd asked for her on a whim, and now I couldn't think of one earthly reason I'd be quizzing her about the Clipper estate. Any hope of a convincing fib went straight out of my head. I pride myself on lying well, but I was drawing a blank. I wondered if I'd be forced to fall back on the truth, a risky proposition at best. Entering her office, this is what I learned. When you gross 6% of $23 million annually, you can decorate your personal space any way you want. Hers was understated elegance, like the public area in a high-class hotel, only with a number of personal touches thrown in. There were fresh flowers on her desk, and I could see angled silver picture frames that probably showcased family members, husband, children, a goofy, lovable dog rescued from the pound. She offered me a seat on a couch upholstered in dove gray. The cushions must have been filled with down because I sank with a sigh of air. She sat in a matching chair, just close enough to suggest intimacy without invading my personal space. The coffee table between us was glass and chrome, but most of the other furnishings were antique. Cheney's talked about you so often, I can't believe our paths have never crossed, she said. Oh, dear. I don't know anyone named Janie, and I was just about to pipe up and confess when I realized what she'd actually said was Cheney. I felt my head tilt metaphorically, and then the penny dropped. My mouth didn't actually flop open, but I was momentarily without speech. This was Cheney Phillips' mother. I remembered then that while his father was X Phillips of the Bank of X Phillips, his mother sold high-end real estate. All I could think to say was, I need help.
Well, I'll do what I can, she said without missing a beat.
I described the situation as succinctly as possible, starting with the phone call from Hallie Betancourt and moving on to our meeting. I repeated the lengthy tale of woe she'd laid on me and then detailed Detective Nash's subsequent revelation about the marked $100 bills. I capped the recitation with my confusion when Vera assured me the Clipper estate had been empty for years. I could see her curiosity mount as mine had, point by point, including the fact that the phone numbers Hallie had given me were non-operant. When I finally paused, she took a moment to reflect. "She went to a great deal of trouble to pull the wool over your eyes," she said. "And it worked like a charm. Honestly, she didn't have to persuade me of anything. She offered me the bait, and I took it. I thought her relationship with Jeffrey was odd, assuming she has a husband by that name, but I didn't doubt for a minute she'd given birth to a son out of wedlock and put the child up for adoption. It didn't even occur to me to question the fact that she'd hoped to make contact with him while keeping her husband in the dark. I quizzed her on a point or two, but I didn't really dig into the story. When she cautioned me to be discreet, it all made perfect sense. I suppose in your line of work, clients are keen on discretion." "Always," I said. "What I don't understand is how she got into the house. She had to be in cahoots with someone in real estate, didn't she? I mean, I can't think how else she could manage it. Could she have broken in?" "No evidence of it that I saw. At the same time, I'm assuming anyone with the right combination could open the lockbox on the property." "True. All that's required for access is to dial it in. Our system's ancient. Some companies are moving to a new device that utilizes an electronic key and keeps a running log of which agents have come and gone, but that's a year or two in the future for us, which is no help to you now." "In the meantime, what's the procedure?" I asked. "I mean, suppose someone has a client who wants to see the house, then what?" "The agent checks the MLS. The multiple listing service," she amended when she saw my look. "Standard instructions are LBCF, which means lockbox, call first, or LBAPT, meaning an appointment is required. In the case of the Clipper estate, all the agents know the house is empty, so no one bothers with either one." "So you're saying anyone and everyone has access?" "As long as they've been given the combination." "In other words, you couldn't just stand there punching in numbers randomly, hoping to hit it right." "I suppose you could if you were lucky," she said. "Come to think of it, how did you get in?" I made a face. "I hauled off and smacked the lock with a chunk of wood, knocking it to kingdom come. I'll be happy to pay to have the lock replaced. Don't worry about it. I'll have Nancy take care of it. She was given the listing because she's worked here for all of 2 months, and she's low man on the totem pole. She'll be thrilled with the mission. We can stop by her office, and I'll introduce you on the way out." "She's not here." "Of course she is." "Really?"